this week's episode and our good shiz debut, Harry Phillips. Harry is without a doubt one of the most talented musicians and songwriters I know. Anyone who's worked with him will know exactly what I'm talking about. He's the kind of person and the kind of presence musically that can really make all the difference when it comes to putting a body of work together. And I'm lucky enough to speak from personal experience here. Harry has been called to work with an impressive collection of artists over the years, both in the studio and live performance environments. He's also a member of one of my all-time favourite bands, Night Flight. Without further ado, here's my conversation with my pal, Harry Phillips.
Hi, Harry.
Hello.
Nice to see you.
You too.
Let's pretend we haven't already done a little bit of an introduction before
hitting
the red button. But yeah, just again, thanks so much for agreeing to do this. And I think I mentioned to you that this is something that I've sort of really been wanting to do for a very long time. And so thanks for taking the time to be my first official guest on the podcast.
This is my first podcast, and I listen to podcasts just all day, every day, like most people do. So
yeah,
very exciting. I feel like I'm on. It's probably like being on TV back in the like 90s.
Yeah,
don't know what to do with your arms.
So I think let's just sort of dive into the questions. I mean, you know, maybe you, I guess you know a little bit about how I know about you, or how I sort of came to know about you. I saw you at that gig at St. Pancras Church, and got sort of really obsessed with Night Flight, and stalked you guys for a while, and then sort of got in touch to do that live session in November 2020, which was loads of fun. But we've never really talked about your background and sort of what brought you to where you are today, and I would just sort of really love to pick your brain and get a better understanding of where everything began for you, I guess. Like where did music start for you, and when did you sort of pick up your first guitar, and what did that all look like?
Well, I mean, this is an obvious answer, but like everybody, you know, listening to music as a kid, you've got the bands that your parents put you onto and stuff. But it feels sort of boring to start with, like, going back into being a child. But I got my first guitar when I was just starting secondary school.
Mm-hmm.
Bought it from my cousin. It was a Yamaha or a Fender Squire, like just the basic black and white Strat guitar with an amp. And I think
what age is that? Because I don't really understand English school systems all that.
I think I was probably 10 or 11.
Okay.
But I don't think I was motivated to get that because of like wanting to learn music more like that's a cool thing to have.
Yeah.
And so I bought it. It was £25. And I think I couldn't play it for like at least 3 or 4 months before I had my first lesson. So it was just sort of in my room getting kicked, mm-hmm. and like I'd turn all the tuning pegs and stuff.
Yeah.
But then when I started secondary school, I started having lessons, and it kind of just took off from there because I had a really great teacher, and all of this music that my parents had put in front of me for my childhood was like suddenly cool to me, like Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin. And also it was at a time when actually everyone in my year group at school was learning guitar. So it wasn't like, you know, I was unique. Everyone was learning like Chili Peppers, and those records would be like By the Way and stuff like that were big records. And so everyone did it. But at a certain point, people sort of drop off, like 14, 15 or something. And at that point at school, I had a band, and we were just obsessed with it. We thought we were going to be the next Metallica. We had band practice like both days of the weekend.
We're
into shredding, and my mate Nick, who's still one of my best friends, when I first met him in first year of secondary school, it was at a mutual friend's house. I didn't know Nick, but this guy invited us both round, and because he knew we both played guitar, although I could probably play a D chord.
Yeah.
We were playing like PlayStation or whatever, and he said to Nick, show Harry that November Rain song.
Oh.
And Nick picked up this crappy little practice guitar, and he just shredded the November Rain Guns N' Roses guitar solo. Like, he was like a prodigy. It was freaky. I'd never seen anyone up close play guitar like that.
Yeah.
And so all through our school years, he kind of like pulled me along, because he would teach me stuff and he would learn all the Slash guitar solos. And then I'd go around his house every night, and we'd like record through one of those little Line 6 pods. Don't you remember those?
Yeah.
And like Satriani and stuff like that. So having like that band all through school was great, because I was learning all of this like technical guitar geekery stuff.
Yeah.
And my fingers could do all this sort of faster shredding, but my brain was very like slow to catch on to music and understanding any sort of theory, or it was just sort of like muscle memory and trying to be impressive.
Just having some like licks in your pocket.
We were just obsessed. We would just spend every like break time at school practicing. Like we'd write songs by sort of the time we were 14, 15, we're sort of writing like heavy metal songs and like performing down in the Civic Center and stuff.
Amazing.
Yeah, and we did some like recording and stuff. We sort of would Google recording studios, and if they were like 40 quid an hour, we'd save up some money and book 2 hours and get like a little demo done.
Amazing.
And our parents would drop us off. Yeah, we were pretty driven.
Yeah, I guess that's the thing. You've got to be obsessed with it, and you've got to have that sort of that like unfiltered obsession that sometimes being a youngster is like the only position that you can be in to have that, because you just don't care about anything else, really. Like, you don't care what it sounds like or if it sounds shit or not. Like, you just go for it.
Yeah, everything I did was like, it was my identity. It was that I was in a band, and so like every project I could do at school was to do with being in a band. Like, if I had art, it would be trying to make an album cover. If we had, you know, like everything was about saving up to buy a better guitar and practicing and writing a song. And we'd go to gigs. Like, well, our parents were so cool about this. We'd go to like metal gigs in London, like in the middle of the week, like on a Wednesday night, they'd drop us at Hammersmith Apollo and we'd go and see like Slayer. Or like Machine Head and stuff, like these crazy metal bands, these three like dorky kids with like terrible haircuts, and we would like wait outside and try and catch the bands as they left the venue right at the end, and try and like give them our CDs with Sharpie written on it.
Wow.
Terrible. That's terrible.
Do you still listen to that stuff? No.
Oh man, I have. My dad's got some CDs. Like we had about 100 band names, and so there's loads of like these little CDs that we made in my dad's office.
Oh please!
But I can't bear to listen to them.
Yeah, I know that feeling. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was all through school. I was just obsessed with guitar and shredding.
And you sort of had lessons, but didn't really do any formal like GCSEs music or anything like that. Or
no, I did do GCSE music, but I didn't really apply myself, and I wasn't really interested in it. And but my teacher at school, my guitar teacher, was a big influence on me, because I wasn't a great kid at school, and I didn't do very well in virtually everything. But the one thing I was guaranteed to do and apply myself at was guitar lessons, like once a week. So I would I sort of ended up just sort of going to him for sort of like therapy, really. We'd sort of sit down for an hour, and half of it would be just like him trying to tell me why I should care about school, and then the other half of it would be like I'm trying to work out this song, or I'd write a song and he'd like give me some pointers on it. But he was like a serious jazz guitar player, and I've had a handful of lessons with him, like kind of recently, over the last few years. And just like marvel at how incredible he is, and thinking, wow, what, he was just giving up his time just to sit in a room and listen to me just chat shy to him and just ask the dumbest questions. And I had this like incredible teacher in front of me. All I did was want to get him to teach me how to play like John Frusciante solos or something.
Yeah, we need those people, I guess, in the world. And do you remember, because I remember my first song that I ever learned, and I remember like for hours and hours and hours just trying to, it was Hey Mr. Tambourine Man, Bob Dylan. And I had this like banged up old nylon acoustic that like lived in the cupboard under the stairs with all of our suitcases and things like that. It was just awful. And when my mom said no to a drum kit, I decided to get this old guitar tuned and fixed, and the whole like, you know, like on an island guitar, there's that metal rod that holds the tuning pegs in place. That basically had to be like glued, super glued to the neck. And so I learned to play on that, and sort of was promised a better guitar as and when. It wasn't just going to sort of be a bit of a phase for me, I guess. But I remember the first song I ever learned to play was Hey Mr. Tambourine Man.
That's a great first song, because that's genuinely a good, you know.
It's a good song, yeah.
Great song. The Bob Dylan version, though, not the Birds, like, jangly version.
Yeah. But that, like, those change, I think the changes from like a D to a G just felt like impossible for small hands on like one of those fat nylon necks.
Yeah.
Like, do you remember things just feeling so painfully difficult?
Yes. I've not forgotten that. And because I've taught a lot of guitar over the years to young kids, like kids younger than when I first started, sort of 8 and 9 years old. And I'm constantly reminded how brutal guitar is. And that's, you know, it's amazing that anyone gets through.
Yeah.
Because unless you've got a guitar that's set up really well and it's like got a low action and the strings aren't rusted, all the strings are rusted on kids' guitars because they don't treat them, they don't care.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's just a nightmare. So if you can get past that, and like, but bar chords were just agony. I can't believe I had this staying power to do it, because, you know, it's hard to get me to do anything these days. You know, like the fact that I had sat down endlessly and like pushed through all this agony is mind blowing to me. I can't relate to whoever that kid was.
But for me, it was like, it was a whole lot better than doing homework.
Yeah.
And obviously I did become obsessed with it as well to an extent, but it was just much better than doing homework.
Yeah. It was like the ultimate way to kill time. And I wasn't just into music. I was like a sporty kid, and like I grew up in the countryside, so I'd be outdoors all the time. But then when it got dark, I'd come in, and it was just guitar till bed. And at that time, like when I was a kid, it was all about like tabs, power tabs, and ultimate guitar.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I would just sit on the computer and just like, you know, drag up all these like ridiculous classic rock songs on power tap and try and learn the guitar parts.
Mm.
And it was just a great, like, what an amazing thing to have access to. Like, and whatever song you wanted, you could just learn the tab for it. It was amazing, really. And I wonder about the older generations that wound back the record and messing around with the needle.
Over
like,
and over again.
I have a nice record collection, and I play records, and I'm terrified of that needle, and they would just like sit and drag it back just to learn one like lick in a song. That's serious, like, energy and commitment to do that.
And then what sort of, I guess that sort of takes us to teens, heading to late teens and sort of approaching leaving school and stuff like that. Where did you go from there? I don't even know. Did you go to uni?
So I got into like mountain biking really in a big way when I was in my late teens.
Really?
And I was like racing a lot. So when I was like 17, I got kicked out of school when I was 16.
Right.
And all my friends that were, I'd been in a band with, they kind of carried on, and I sort of started at this new college. And at that point, I was just deep into mountain biking. So I sort of stopped playing guitar for about a year or two. And I just wanted to do bikes. Like, I'm quite an obsessive person. So I just go deep into something. And so when it came to going to uni, I wanted to do like an outdoors adventure degree. It was like, I was never going to do anything academic. I had no real like thoughts about doing music for a career at that point, even though I had before, but not by the time I was going to uni. I just wanted to like race bikes and like ski and do sort of outdoor activities. So I went to Worcester University, like a small little town in west of England, just because it was close to all of these like mountains in Wales where I've raced bikes. So I literally chose the uni that I thought like I could take my bike there, and every weekend or whatever, or when I'm not at lectures, I can just go and ride. But like the summer before I went to uni, I like dislocated my knee, and I had really bad like tears and snapped ACL and stuff. So I had knee surgery before I went to uni. So when I got to uni, I was on crutches, and I spent like the first couple of months on crutches. And I kept redoing my injury, like in a nightclub. Like in a nightclub, I like slipped and my knee dislocated, and they had to turn the lights off and get an ambulance. Like it was nuts. It was such a chaotic way to start uni. But by like halfway through my first year, I sold my bike. I was like, I'm going to be on like doing rehab for like a year on my knee. Like I'm never going to ride. So I sold my bike in Birmingham. And with the money that I got, the cash, I went straight to like guitar, and I bought like an old Focusrite interface and a Taylor acoustic.
Amazing.
And I just started getting back into it. And I was just in my little flat at uni, just like learning how to sort of write songs and play acoustic guitar. And then I didn't look back into like the outdoor stuff. I just left it behind. So I had to sort of coast through this degree that I wasn't interested anymore, because I was like, I'm going to be a musician again. And I was like at uni, but driving to London to play to like five people in Shoreditch on like a Tuesday night, or go to an open mic. I'd drive like hours up the motorway to do like open mics, then go back for a lecture the next day. And my housemates at uni in second and third year, we didn't see each other, because I would just pop in, turn up for a lecture, and then get my guitar and go.
Weird how it like it almost like you were kind of forced to pick up the guitar again and to get back into it. And
completely. And I just like I already had all of this like sort of coordination with the guitar from being a teenager, and like all those hours I put in, but now I was interested in like songwriting and finger picking and all these new skills, but it wasn't like learning from scratch. So it was like sort of just adjusting my guitar playing to like the tastes of what I was listening to and stuff, and just listening to loads of music, just getting stoned and just listening to like going blasting through all the music from the 60s and 70s, just quite diligently. I don't know why, but I just did Nick Drake and Neil Young and John Martin and stuff. And I just was obsessed with it. So by the time I left uni, I had been like gigging loads in London, and I had a couple of friends who are a bit older than me, two brothers in Chesham, which is like the next town from where I grew up. And I moved into their house. But, like the day I handed my dissertation in, my car was packed, and I just went to this house. And this house was just full of music. Mm. Like there were just guitars everywhere. The biggest record collection, just jazz playing all day, piano, jams, and then a really nice recording studio in the garden.
Amazing.
So I spent the whole of uni like practicing guitar, and then I like arrived at this sort of bohemian house where everything, like everyone was a musician, musicians in and out all day, that became like my best mates. And I spent two years there just like absorbing music, just inhaling it just constantly.
Yeah.
And that was when I sort of just completely became obsessed with practicing guitar and writing and recording.
Yeah. And how does writing sort of tend to unfold for you? Is it something that you really make quite a conscious effort to sit down and do regularly enough, or is it that songs will catch you doing random things at random times, but you know it may happen this week and next week, but then not again for another few months? Like, what's
it can be all of those things. It can be all of those things, but there's definitely been years of my life where I've written like really regularly, you know, like daily sort of thing. Because I do believe it's like a muscle, and you just like, you get in the habit of just, of doing it, and you're like fit, you're like writing fit, and it's just kind of easy. And now I don't have like the time to just sit and think about it. So it's like, it's rare. Yeah, it's rare, but I still get those thoughts. Like if I hear an interesting phrase or something, or like you, what was it you said ages ago? Like you have a little expression, and I said that's got to be your album title.
Oh yeah, you can only go as far as the headlights reach.
As far as the headlights reach, yeah. Like that, those kinds of things trigger like an idea. But it is rare these days that I'll actually go and pick up a guitar, and like write it out. But it can happen anyway. But it you know, sometimes it's like it happens at an annoying time, like as you're out the door, you pick up a guitar for a few minutes and it's like, oh, something's come to me. Yeah. And then you sit with the guitar for hours the next day and nothing comes.
Yeah. Or drifting off to sleep. I hear this one all the time. It happens to me all the time.
Yeah. Or you hear like a little melody or something.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll hear a little melody or you know, something will. Yeah, I'll just be sort of repeating a set of lyrics over and over that just would have come to me from something I'd been reading or whatever. But you know, the light's off and you're sort of halfway
into it. And then do you get up and like do something about
it? Sometimes. I mean, I've got about 1,000 voice notes on my phone.
Yeah.
And I feel like that is, just I have the best intentions to sit and work through that kind of stuff. And I guess maybe for the next set of songs that we end up doing, I definitely will carve out some time to do that. But yeah, it's so weird. It's so weird how these little ideas come to you and catch you. And do you ever sort of find yourself consciously thinking about a particular song or a particular artist or a particular feel or a particular vibe and then going after writing something from that?
Yeah, definitely. Like sometimes it's often like a groove. Like I went to see this jazz guitar player Julian Large at the Union Chapel 2 weeks ago, and it's the first gig I've been to in years. Literally, I just don't go to gigs. But there was one like song. I don't even know what the song was called, but it was just, it started off with just an insanely good groove, and so I just got my iPhone voice note thing out and recorded it because I just thought that's begging for a banging chorus over the top of it.
Yeah.
But I don't know, it's like the thing that's addictive about songwriting, I think, is like that initial idea that sparks. Mm-hmm. And what I'm not good at is like following on from the initial thing. So like I'll get if a chorus idea comes to me and I'm excited by it, then I can fairly quickly get a verse together, and I'll be able to get the song to a presentable level where I can sing a verse, two verses, and a chorus. And if I'm lucky, there's a middle eight there. But what I'm not good at is sitting on that and then tearing it apart and building it and tearing it apart and building it. I kind of just, I love that initial thrill, and then I'm sort of done with it.
Yeah.
Whereas all of the projects that I've been involved in that are worth anything, it's never that you have to be able to, you have to be prepared to like go into them hard
and
I'm not saying you have to, like of course songs can come out in 10 minutes and be perfect, but
it's just not always the way.
But I'm never happy with my like initial idea, but for some reason I'm very reluctant to ever change it. I don't know if that, I think that's common, but my, like my friend, like you and my friend Sam, I've got two friends, Sam, that both write really regularly and they're always good. And I'm sure they write songs that aren't good, but we just don't hear them. But they it's like a job. They don't treat it like a job, but they approach it with a drive of like a startup company where it's just like, I've got to do this. And as a result, they're amazing at it. And I'm very like out of shape with it all these days. And so like maybe I'll write a song a year or something that I'm happy with. But I really love just getting involved in other people's songs now and just like adding a trick or two into a song with a chord change or something. That's just as thrilling to me as like starting from scratch.
Yeah. And how consciously do you think you are with like selecting particular chords for particular feels or like something that we've mentioned before in the studio, for example, when Aid was playing that like run through of stuff for driving down, you were like, oh no, I need more of the dominant seventh for that particular sound. And obviously you've associated that sound for the type of emotion that you want to feel. But I'm just trying to like, how consciously when you sit down to write something or when you sit down to like help someone else flesh something out, do you feel like you sort of reach for the archive of things that you know about how things fit together, or do you just sort of go by feel and by gut? I guess it's probably a combo.
I think it's like, if I'm writing a song like from scratch, there's not a lot of thought involved. You know, it's like a couple of chords that like encourage me to sing a melody over them. But I'm a bit obsessed with like seventh chords and like adding color to if you come with a four chord song, I will tend to overdo it with like adding major sevenths and dominant sevenths where I can. Because they just like they like pull a bit of emotion out of the chord.
Yeah.
But I have grappled in the past with like the more I learn about music and music theory, because it's taken me so long to get to this point where I have any sort of basic understanding of theory. It didn't come quickly to me. It's like something that I've developed as an adult. Like I have to be careful where I don't lose the thing that started the
magic
musical journey, because like you learn all these tricks and they click and you start to understand stuff, but you do have to like remove that sort of the thinking part of it. But it's really handy when working with other people, because hopefully their song's great and they've not done the thinking part. They've just like emoted. Yeah. And released this amazing thing. And then I find it really handy to be like, substitute this chord for this in this little turnaround, and just add a little moment between chorus one and verse two.
Yeah. Okay.
And then it's really handy to just be able to like grab a chord.
Yeah. And just to make things more interesting. I mean, I have first-hand experience of you doing stuff like that with my tracks, I think I used to write more when I literally knew absolutely nothing about anything, honestly. And I thought at one stage, you know, when you get to like campfire guitarist level, and you know you can bang out like 10 or 15 covers pretty comfortably, you think you kind of made it. And I mean, in my late teens and early 20s, I kind of genuinely thought that. But you know, the more you peel away at these things, the more you realize that there's so much more to learn and to know and to understand. Yeah, that can almost be detrimental to productivity and just that innocence and magic of what makes a song unique and special, you know.
Think how many songs you wouldn't have written if you hadn't found a capo or like learned how to use a capo.
Yeah.
Because like the campfire chords, the kind of open cowboy chords, whatever you want to call them, there is a magic to those shapes. Like they allow so many so much more complicated ideas to be available to you easily than you could possibly do as a writer and as somebody not thinking too much.
Yeah.
Than if you had to play them like bar chords up the neck, you know? Mm. And so many times it's like, why am I struggling with this song that's in B flat? Oh, why don't I just bung a capo on it? And like suddenly my home chord is just a G shape.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, there's all these extensions and
yeah.
And like extra voicings I can add, and it feels like home. And like, there's nothing wrong with that. Sometimes at some point along the way, I sort of told myself it wasn't the done thing. You had to kind of understand everything you were doing, you know, and make it hard for yourself. But capos, man.
Yeah, for sure.
An invention.
And what about, like, when did Night Flight come together for you? Did you always know Sam, or was that... Where did that start? I don't even know how long it's been. I mean, I've known about you guys for a good 5 or 6 years by now, I guess.
Yeah. I think I joined in 2017, or maybe the end of 2016. But basically, like, from when I moved into that house in after uni, I joined a band that I was just, like, completely in love with and incredibly happy to be a part of and loved what we did. And that sort of fell apart. And at the same time that fell apart, I sort of had this like insane drive to become like a sort of studio session guitarist. Mm. So I was like wanting to be a band guy, but I was also like trying to just get all of these chops under my fingers and amass all this gear and like want to be able to do it all and be like, turn up to a funk gig or like play with Nile Rodgers one day and then be like blues virtuoso. So I was practicing so much guitar. And then like at some point, someone like sort of tagged me in a Facebook post or something that was like from Night Flight, who I didn't know who they were. And it was like, they were looking for a guitar player. They put like a post up or something. And like two people had tagged me in the comments. And I don't know why I did, but I just got in touch. I think they had like, it just said Night Flight, and it was like very mysterious looking who they were. Like there was no images of Night Flight. It was just black with white writing Night Flight. Anyway, I just got in touch with Sam and sort of went to meet him for what I thought was like a sort of audition.
Mm.
But looking back, like I just don't think anyone else got in touch. I think he just was like, I was the first guy that actually showed up meet him. And we just got on really well. Like but what was weird is that at the time I was like deep in this world of like sort of learning jazz and fusion, like just wanting to be a do-it-all guitar player.
Mm.
And then I joined this band where I didn't know anybody in it, but it was like clever music with interesting chords. But the more I sort of bought like technical or sort of capable guitar playing into the rehearsals, like the worse it was going down with Dan, the drummer, or the rest of the guys, where it was sort of like I was trying to be too slick or like bluesy or something. So I had to really quickly like try and unlearn all of this idea about like how to be in this song on guitar and just like be emotional rather than just trying to impress people or show that I'm a really good guitar player.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was long-winded. So that was like 2017. And like, it was so exciting because they were signed to a label, and the first gig I did, there was like 6 or 7 people there sort of from the label or the booking agent or like the publishing company, that I was just like, oh my God, like cool people like hanging around with my band. Like that's never happened in all the bands I've been in. Like we're the least cool people in the room. And now like we look like the cool kids. And I was just like, totally, I thought, this is it. I'm going to make it.
Yeah.
And every gig was just getting better and better. And we had sort of like photo shoots and signing vinyl and all these sort of like meetings in high rise buildings in Soho. Isn't and just that? Like, just totally just thinking this is it. And the music that we were making was, I was really proud of. And Sam, yeah, the writer was just so driven. Like, I've never met anybody so driven. Like, yeah, he just did not stop writing songs. And the more I like took an interest in the songwriting and hearing what he was doing, the more he write. It was like he gets spurred on by your interest. And so we just became like best mates, and we just like all night, all day, all night, just be sending, he'd be sending me songs and I'd be, love this one, not this one.
Yeah.
But then in the background, like, cogs were turning, and we were like getting all this good press and getting support slots with bands we really liked. And it was just all happening, really busy. And so I just sort of wore this hat of I'm in a band and it's about to kick off.
Yeah.
And now 6-7 years later, I'm still in the band, and I think the music's like as good as it's ever been. But a lot of that bullshit's sort of dropped away, and we're just making it for ourselves, really.
Yeah.
And it's just Sam and me now. Ollie, the our sort of multi instrumentalist, bassist, keyboard player, guitar player, he's still in it, but we've gone through a lot of people. Yeah. Aside from him, and I think I'll just keep working with Sam's until I'm dead, to be honest, because he's just I've not met anyone who like can so regularly move me with a song. It's sort of freakish, really.
Well,
it's like a competition to him, but he wins every time. He wins every time. But if he thinks I'm sort of like not into a couple of songs he's written, like, he'll just, the next one will just destroy me. And it's just a Wednesday. And the Friday, Wednesday, there's another one. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So that's sort of where I've been at. And so I've done, you know, jumped on board with other projects while doing that. And dipped my toe in the function world a bit and done some production stuff with you and some other artists that I really love. But that's been my main project for the last 6-7 years.
Yeah. And when you said something earlier about developing songs and developing ideas and the time that it can sometimes take for that stuff to unfold, I saw a video of you guys jamming on a song. I think it's called Imogen or something. Is that right? And it looked like it was from a while ago, but I don't know if it's anywhere near released yet or
that song just came out.
But how old is it?
Oh, really old.
Yeah. So
2018. 2018 that song was recorded.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just, this fascinates me, because I heard something the other day about someone saying, but your songs are like your babies. And it was Bono, actually. Bono was like, no, man, your songs are like your parents. They kind of tell you what to do. Like, they'll present themselves. Yeah, I know.
Interesting.
He was like, the song ultimately tells you how it wants to be written and what it's calling for. And I just thought that was really, really profound.
That is.
How long do you guys sort of typically find yourselves working on a song? Or, I guess, it varies. Also with High Fidelity, and one of the messages you mentioned, like, oh God, this song's like finally out in the world and like it's really slayed us. And even with the stuff that we're doing now, like, you know, at every turn you kind of go, how much longer is this going to be? Because actually there's more to come, you know, how.
Yeah, that is a topic of like serious discussion with me and Sam, and because, you know, the writing part of Night Flight is so quick and so easy and to be honest with you, effortless. Like, it's very rare that we've ever got stuck on a song. And when we first, or throughout the whole time I've been with the band, we've had just an embarrassment of riches when it comes to recording studios and studio time, where people have backed us to go into studios and given us time and helped us pay for that. And so, like, we've just had this, like, crazy backlog of really amazingly recorded stuff.
Right.
And, like, especially when we had a label and a manager that was pushing us in directions that probably weren't where we were interested in going, like, a lot of stuff would get shelved that we thought was amazing. I'm not kidding. We have, like, two whole albums that haven't been released that I just don't think will ever be released.
Wow.
And they're not songs we played live. They're just completely hidden away, because we just had this period where we could just go into a studio and just almost as regularly as we wanted and record a whole batch of songs, and then a month or two later be back in and do a whole batch more. Imogen was recorded in 2018 or 2019, maybe beginning of 2019, and it was, like, my favorite song that we'd done, and for whatever reason it just wasn't picked for the next EP or release or whatever, because it was kind of, like, a bit more rocky or driven than our other stuff. So we just sat on it, and then, like, the next release comes, and, well, it doesn't really sit with this bunch of songs, and the next release, and, like, that's just one song of many examples where it's just been, you just, like, this may never come out. But that, it really bugs me, because, and maybe it's different for Sam because they're, you know, predominantly his songs, but I just want to get them out. And that's that goes against, like, every bit of advice you ever get from the industry, which is, like, take your time, have a strategy, labor over it. No, the market's not right at the moment. Hold on to this one. This is your strong, you know, like, there's so much bullshit. I just want to get it out. And if we went with my strategy, we'd probably be nowhere. But there's a part of me that thinks, at least, like, when I'm 90, we'll have this enormous portfolio of tracks, and I'll love every single one of them. So I just, I'm just on a quest at the moment to just try and get them all out, because they never stop. And it's like a weird nightmare where it's like gone into a recording studio, agonized over 10 tracks, come out, like, 3 months later, they're still not released, and there's another, like, 30 tracks that have just been written since then. And it's like, I can't keep up. Like, it's frightening. So that really bugs me. Like, sitting on stuff bugs me, because inevitably then you end up, like, High Fidelity is a song where we've recorded it, like, 4 or 5 times. And just nothing has ever beaten the way Sam plays it on an acoustic guitar. And for some reason, we've never just recorded that. But it's just, it takes the fun away for me personally, like, if you just do songs over and over again. Like, I can get into it in a nice studio and have fun with, like, a rearrangement. But ultimately, like, they're never really bettered. They're just different versions of the same thing. So it's an interesting one. I haven't got my head around it. With my own stuff, I really don't care. Like, I've got a record I've been working on with Tom at the Bookhouse for coming up 4 years. And I'm just moving at a snail's pace with it. And it's like that thing I said earlier, like, the initial thrill is what gets me. And then after that, I don't have the like patience to just chip away at it endlessly. And with recording, like, it's even more exaggerated, because you have these, like, ideas in your head, this song that you've written on a guitar at home, and then you get in a studio with a drummer and you lay a drum track down, and then quickly give me the bass, quickly give me the electric guitar, add some keys, put a guide vocal on it, and you're like, ah, there it is. All these ideas I had in my head. And then the next bit is like, oh, now I'll come back to it in a few months. And then, like, then it's even harder to open that book back up. It's like imagine the best chapter of any book is the first chapter. and then you keep putting it down, and then like you got to try and keep reminding yourself to read past the to the second chapter, but, and knowing there's like 100 chapters of this book, and it's going to take you like it's going to take you a long time to like get tick all the boxes that you want till you're happy with it.
Yeah,
it's something I need to get better at.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
I mean, you're experiencing that now.
Yeah, yeah, I really am. I really am at every turn. You know, you're like, oh, we're nearly there. Oh no, actually, we're not. Oh, we're nearly there.
And
we are closer, I guess, and that's something. But yeah, it's so. I think there's such a fine line between done and just, you know, keep on. Should we change this? Should we do that? Could I get the vocals better? You know, could we? And actually, as you say, like realistically, if we had to go and re-record Wannabe, for example, like would we get it any better or any closer to what it is now? I think sometimes fresh can deceive you in a way.
Do you think
that it's better?
But yeah, 100%. Like, and that's what can cause the endless back and forth, because the new thing is always the best thing.
Yeah.
But I wonder if, like, to you, to get to the finish line, is it getting the songs to a point where you listen to them and you think that's going to blow people away? Or is it getting them to a point, and this is, I think, where I am, getting them to a point where they sit somewhat equally in my mind with the stuff I listen to in terms of, like, quality? And that's the hardest thing, is sort of always falling short of the great records that I want this record to sound like. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
What is it you're waiting for before you go, oh, I'm finished with this? Because you could just say, I want it to be the best it can be, but there's no finish line to that. That's an subjective.
Yeah, I'm so happy with the songs and what we've gotten done and what we've achieved, and I'm super proud of them, and I think you are too. I think there's questions in my mind that I can quickly just go, like, I've thought about redoing the bass for Everything About You. And I can quickly just go like, no, stop it, no. But yeah, I think for now it's just about really settling on some mixed references that I like, and trying some different things, and being in the room with Tom, so that we can actually all collaborate and be a part of what we feel like is going to be the best sound coming back from a mixed perspective. And then I think we're there, you know.
Yeah.
Because as I said the other day, sorry, now this is becoming about me, but as I said the other day, I think, you know, such an important part of this creative process that I've learned through recording this set of songs is that when they're done, like, you need to sort of reach a point where you just set them free, and, you know, you need to make space for new things, because I know this isn't my best work. I know this isn't the best of what I'm going to produce creatively. I know that there's so much more to find and to sort of tap into, you know, and ultimately you need to create space. You need to create space for that and learn from what you're working on right now, so that you can invite the next set of ideas in and, you know, give them space to grow.
Yeah, and what a crazy concept you touched upon, that this isn't your best work, because I think about all of the classic, like, storied career songwriters that we all celebrate, like Dylan or Neil Young, whoever, like, their best work, like, is widely regarded as the stuff they did when they were in their early 20s. Mm. Like the best Dylan stuff came out in the 60s, maybe early 70s at a push. After that, like there's some amazing music that I love and everyone loves, but the seminal albums were when they were like in their 20s. And yet if you ask Bob Dylan what his favorite, what his best work was, he would probably tell you it's the last record that he made that I haven't listened to. Right. Actually, to be honest, I may have listened to the last Dylan one, but you know, virtually no one would say that's probably their favorite Dylan record.
Yeah.
Like, how strange is it that our perception of everything we do in music and everything we record, like we finish it and go, oh, the next one will be so much better. I'll know what to do. I won't make that mistake again. And that doesn't stop until you stop making music.
Mm.
But that's not how the audience and listener perceives your music at all. And the thing with like recording a bass line again and again and again, you can get it. And every time you do it, you're learning more about what you didn't like about the last one that you did.
Yeah.
But that's not to say that the person listening to the first one doesn't think that's perfect.
Mm.
And that's not going to be that could be their favorite ever.
Totally. It's so subjective, isn't version. It? But as a songwriter someone's said this to me before, because I work in music education and I talk to a lot of people who are sort of in their adult years learning the piano later on in life and writing songs later on in life. And I'm talking about 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s plus, which is really interesting to sort of gather thoughts and feelings from people from such different walks of life. But I chatted to someone who said, oh yeah, Paul McCartney's best work is kind of all behind him now. And I kind of feel the same way about myself. You know, I'm sort of an age where maybe it's just not going to get any better than this. And I was like, well, if you think that, then you're kind of like shooting yourself in the foot a little bit, because yeah, I can't be of the mindset that the last song I wrote is the best it's going to get for me. You know, you've kind of just got to go on as you intended to, and regardless of whether or not it's going to be the best, or you know, you've got to keep on writing, you've got to keep on going, and it's not about what's going to be the best. And but yeah, I sort of feel creatively like I'm growing all the time, you know.
Yeah, there's not really a skill, and it is like writing music is a skill. And there's not really another skill on the planet where you don't just, the arc doesn't carry on going.
Mm.
Like the older you get and the more you do it, you get better at it. Mm. The thing, like knowing how rich and complicated and just painful and beautiful life is, like as the older you get, the more you go through, the more experience you get and the wiser you hope to get. To look back and think, like, I did my best self-expression and writing, like, in my early 20s is a crazy thought.
Mm.
Like, what did I was an idiot. If I think about every other aspect of my life in my early 20s, I was a moron. To think that my best work was done then and isn't going to keep, it's not going to keep getting better is a crazy thought.
Because
you just experience so much life and
yeah.
Experiencing things is like what makes you a better writer, I believe.
Yeah. And I feel like that attitude will limit you from just continuing. And that's all you should really be thinking about doing is just not stopping.
Yeah.
Just carrying on.
And just live. Just go through heartbreak and pain and success and failure, and it'll give you like more colors to paint with. And
yeah.
But it's tough. Yeah. It's hard to keep a lot with life. It's just hard to find time to write. It's hard to find time to sit down and do the thing that like you're not going to get paid for when you've got like a family and you've got rent to pay and car with a flat tire. And
yeah.
It's like, you've got to have, there's got to be like a, something to keep you going with it, you know?
Yeah. I guess that's one of the other things that I wanted to talk about tonight, although I can appreciate the time and I won't keep you too much longer, but yeah, just your thoughts on what it means to be a working musician with a family and, you know, huge responsibilities to survive and, you know, trying to sort of manage those two things separately together. It's hectic. How do you keep yourself going with things, with music?
Well, it's probably not a great time for me to answer that because having just had a baby,
yeah,
a few months ago, and having just a bonkers 4-year-old running around,
yeah,
like I don't feel like I have any sort of hold or like idea of what's going on at the moment in life. It's just like survival mode.
Yeah.
And so like for now, like I've done so little music recently and played so little guitar that it's like I'm starting to panic, like will I ever get back to it, like when will I ever find time to play again? But obviously I know it will. It's not going to disappear, but it's hard. Like it's hard to like knuckle down and do something that isn't music,
yeah,
for the benefit of your, you know, family and finances, and then still think like you've got a chance at being a musician and making that a full-time gig. It's like a terrifying thing. It's like the more of the other thing you do, you feel like it detracts from your chances of doing music. So it's quite a scary time, honestly, for me at the minute, because I just don't know how to like pour the energy that I want into that.
Yeah.
But one thing that has never changed for me is that I'm absolutely obsessed with listening to music. And whenever things go, you know, like I get sick of guitar or writing or I get depressed with the industry or whatever it is over the years that's thrown me off course, like the thing that never changes is listening. And so I think all I need to do to remain like a musician and in the game, it's just to keep listening to music.
Yeah.
Because as long as you're listening to music and pushing yourself to listen, not just listening to like the same few albums, even though that's mostly what I do. Like if you actually push yourself to keep listening, you're just going to learn. Even if you're not picking up the guitar and even if you're not like doing it 24/7.
Yeah.
Like I have this like innate need to feel like the emotion of music. Like we all do, but no matter how like bummed out I am, like I get this like overwhelming need to like have myself go through more hurt, like listening to an Elliott Smith record that I know is going to make me well up. Like, so I think just listening to music and just keeping that like sense of wonderment about that is what I'm gonna use to get me kind of through the times where I may need to just, you know, do something else for a little bit.
Yeah.
And then I've got, you know, the project we're working on is like more important to me now than ever because it's like my main outlet for. You know, leaving like I said about it earlier, like in a jokey way, but I do mean it. The older I get, the more I just think I just want a great portfolio at the end of all of this.
Yeah.
I want every record I work touch to be something I'm proud of.
Yeah.
And that is the motivation more than like earning money through music or being able to say that that pays my bills exclusively. I don't really care. I just want to work on stuff that I can be proud of and is a good use of my time.
Yeah. Well, that's the stuff you got to go after, really. I mean, first and foremost, it's got to be about making stuff that you're proud of and stuff that means something to you. I think the rest will slot into place. I've had the best time talking with you about this stuff. I could honestly go on forever.
Me too.
I've got a few more questions bursting, but maybe we'll do this again sometime. And
yeah.
Yeah, thanks so much, Hare.
It's been great.
This is in a way, it's obviously we've gotten to know each other quite well over the course of the last few months, couple of years, however long it is. But yeah, for me, it's a pleasure to chat to you about music and have been such a big fan of your work and can't wait for the next
you set too.
of things going on.
And I want to say I've been terrible through my sort of career in music at doing anything that I'm not completely inspired by. I just suck at having to fake it on any sort of gig or do function stuff. Like, no matter how good the money is, I just wear this resting bitch face the whole time. And I just suck at it. I can't turn it on for the money and just do something shit. And you getting in touch with me and wanting to work with me has given me such a boost in just my love for music and my wanting to keep doing it, because it's like, this is finally something I can sink my teeth into. And it's like, I need to thank you for giving me that opportunity, because your music is incredibly emotional and so real that I can't believe I've been able to be the person that brings it into the world with you. It's without doubt exactly what the epitome of what I mean when I say looking back at stuff you're proud of, because it's just really powerful music and I'm really proud of it. And thank you for giving me this whole thing, because I really needed it.
Thanks, Brew.
Selfishly.
Yes to many more. I appreciate your time so much. I know how much you've got going on at the moment, and thanks for being numero uno guest on my
what an honor. Of course.
And I will catch you again really soon.
Cool. Love you, Kate.
Okay, hair. Love you, man. Ciao.
See ya.
Bye.
Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. There is plenty, plenty, plenty more to come. So if you're new to the show, make sure you subscribe. You can find us in all the usual places, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, etc. On socials, at TheGoodShiz00, as well as via our website, www.thegoodshiz.com. We'll see you next time.